Aspire Underwriters versus Simpkins. If the clerk will please announce counsel who will be arguing today.
May it please the court, Mr. Vera, Phil Vera to argue for the appellant, Mrs. A. Robert Lambert to argue for the appellant.
All right, Mr. Silvera.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Daryl Silvera and I represent the folks at Aspire Underwriters, the appellant in this particular case. As the court may be well aware, this is an appeal of a DWC decision, a workers' compensation claim. The issue before the Workers' Compensation Commission and the court was whether or not Mr. Simpkins sustained or had a compensable injury on September 9th, 2005, resulting in his death. The facts in this case, I believe, are basically undisputed as to what happened. Mr. Simpkins was a cashier at Coca-Cola Enterprises at Fossil Creek. His job was to count money and do paperwork. He worked inside an office, air-conditioned environment. On September 9th, 2005, he arrived at work at approximately 10 a.m. He began his job duties. At approximately 9:13 a.m., Mr. Simpkins walks from the cash office to the driver room to do some more paperwork. Mike Edwards comes into the driver room, greets him. Mr. Simpkins starts to walk out of the driver room. He stops. He tries to hold on to a doorway and literally collapses. This is one of those cases where the facility keeps a lot of cash because it's Coca-Cola, they're bringing money in from the vending machines. The area is under surveillance. This is one of those cases where a picture is worth a thousand words. So I'm going to present to you the video surveillance for the court to understand exactly what happened. As you can see, the video surveillance here shows four screens. In the bottom right corner is Mr. Simpkins wearing the red shirt. So you see him in the cash office. The bottom left is what we call the driver room. The door at the top left is the door that goes in and out of the driver room. So you'll see Mr. Simpkins leave the cash office, and there's a window down the bottom left that separates the driver room and the cash room. So you see Mr. Simpkins up at the top left coming out with a cart, going from the cash office to the driver room. At the bottom left, you see him come into the driver room. At which time he stops there and he is doing some paperwork. If you'll look in the top left corner in a few seconds, Mr. Edwards will walk in to the facility and then he'll walk into the driver room located at the bottom. That's Mr. Edwards coming in, the big fella, and you'll see that he walks into the door on the hallway and you'll see him enter down the bottom. So you've got views of what's going on both inside that door and outside that door. Watch Mr. Simpkins, he goes to walk out, he stops. And simply keels over. It is an unfortunate event. It's tragic. Experts in this case indicated he had complete loss of postural tone. So we contend that in this particular case, He did not have a compensable injury because his fall and resulting injury did not arise out of his employment. And the courts have held that, and we've got 6 points of error. In connection with the first point of error, which deals with the compensable injury in the course and scope of employment, it's very important that the labor code under section 401.011 subsection 10 in the new law, what we call the new law in 1991, defined compensable injury. Compensable injury had never previously been defined in the statute. There was a definition of injury in course and scope. But in the new law in 1991, they added an additional component. And the additional component was, for an injury to be compensable, the injury must arise out of the employment and be in the course and scope of employment. If the court would look at the first handout, which is on your desk, in order for an injury to be compensable, there basically has to be three requirements met. One, that there is that the injury arises out of the employment, and two, that it is in the course and scope of employment. And course and scope of employment additionally has two additional prongs. It has to be an activity which deals with the employment and something that originates out of the employment and something that the employee is doing to further the business affairs of the employer. So in this particular case, the evidence that was submitted to the court at trial simply established that Mr. Simpkins' fall did not originate as an employment, didn't arise out of his employment. Unfortunately, he was at work when it happened. Now, the courts have talked about the positional risk test. In the Brachter case, it was a very similar case. Mr. Brachter was at work. He collapsed, hit his head on a bathtub. Now, he was working as an oil rig worker out on the site. He died. The trial court granted a summary judgment in favor of the widow and the children, saying that he had a compensable injury in the course and scope of employment. The El Paso Court of Appeals reversed and rendered in that particular case. And what's interesting is they stated, workers' compensation is not general health insurance. Workers' compensation is to cover injuries that are an inherent risk to the job that's being done, not for general ailments. And in the Brachter case, Mr. Brachter had either an aneurysm or a stroke and collapsed, hit his head, and died.
But now, isn't one of the problems we have in this case is that really there's not expert testimony as to the true causation of the head injury?
I believe there is. And it's similar to, when we get back to the Brachter case, they found Mr. Brachter in the course and scope of employment based on personal comfort doctrine. What they said was, under the positional risk test, it's not a compensable injury because it is not a risk. He was subject to having that condition anywhere. It didn't necessarily be at work or at home or anywhere else. And what they said in that case was, he just happened to be at work when it happened. The work didn't cause the condition. In this particular case, you have expert testimony from two doctors, Dr. Nieto, who is a neurologist. In his report, it's exhibit, Plaintiff's Exhibit 1, he testified, or his report says, in reasonable medical probability, he either had a stroke, a TIA, or an arrhythmia. So they couldn't say it was either the stroke, the TIA, or the arrhythmia. He said it was one of those conditions, that Mr. Simpkins had a catastrophic event inside of his body that caused him to collapse. Now, with regard to the eyewitness testimony, a testimony from Mr. Edwards, who says his eyes rolled back, he shook, and he was out before he hit the floor. That's uncontradicted. You have testimony from Mac Cleveland, Melody Sims, and Joe Etherly, all who were employees there, who said there was nothing on the premises, that he didn't slip and fall, he didn't trip and fall, as the video indicates. There's no substance on the floor. There's nothing about his employment that caused him to fall. There were no noxious fumes. Dr. Nieto also testified that, in his opinion, based on reasonable medical probability, the cause of the fall was not work-related and was not related to his employment. That testimony was uncontradicted. What is also imperative is, I believe, Dr. Krause's testimony, which was the claimant's expert, indicated in his opinion he was not rendering an opinion concerning the cause of the fall. He was only testifying as to what happened after. And during his testimony, it came out that during his autopsy, he never autopsied the heart, the lungs. He made no autopsy determination. Did he have a stroke? Did he have a myocardial infarction? Did he have an arrhythmia? He didn't do it because he didn't even autopsy those parts of the body. He only looked at his head. More importantly, Dr. Krause testified that Mr. Simpkins would have had the same injuries if this fall happened at home, at church, at a mall, and in fact, during cross-examination at trial, I had him admit, if he keeled over right in this courtroom, he would have had the same injuries that he had when he fell at work.
But is that true of almost any injury?
Not necessarily. And it goes back to the issue of what the Bracker case talks about, positional risk and it being an inherent risk to the employment versus a condition of life that we deal with, and they just happens to happen at work. More importantly, the Crump case, the Supreme Court said, we have to focus in on what was the event that was responsible for the harm, not the result. And that's exactly what this case is about. Because Mr. Simpkins had a tragic situation. He just happened to be at work when he collapsed.
Ask a hypothetical.
Yes, Your Honor.
What if he had, at the moment he walked out the door and turned, what if he had just tripped and fell and hit his head on the floor and suffered the head injuries? Would that make a different case?
Unfortunately, under the law, sometimes yes, it would. I mean, that's why we went to the extent of establishing that there was no condition that caused him to collapse. If he was walking down the hall and someone had spilled a Coke on the floor and he slipped and fell on the Coke, that would have been a compensable injury in the course and scope of employment. But here, his fall originated inside of his body due to a personal defect in his health condition, not having to do anything with his employment. So that's what makes this case particularly different. So, in connection with point of error number one, I think it's also important to note that the issue is, was there any evidence or scintilla in evidence establishing that his fall and resulting injury arose out of his employment? There is none. There is no testimony from any fact witness that it arose out of his employment. There's no testimony from any expert witness that it arose out of his employment. In fact, the testimony from the experts and the fact witnesses were that his fall and resulting injuries did not arise out of his employment. So we believe, in connection with point of error number one, that as a matter of law, we established that his injury did not arise out of his employment. And therefore, the jury's verdict should be reversed and a decision rendered in our favor. Now, let's move on to point of error number two. Point of error number two is the producing cause.
Quickly,
I'm telling you, it's flying. On point of errors 2, 3, and 4, and 5 on the jury charge, I think your decision is simple. We objected to a producing cause definition because, one, it wasn't an issue before the DWC, and two, it was an incorrect statement of the law on producing cause. Now, no, Your Honor. In fact, there is a case on point, and I believe the court and clerks need to read Continental Casualty versus James Baker.
And I read that, actually.
And
I know you're saying it shouldn't have been in there at all.
Correct.
But then your backup is, okay, if it was going to be in there, it should have been the Crump definition.
Correct.
The Crump should be applied retroactively.
Correct.
But still, if you're going to say it should have been in there, and it should have been in there, why don't you have the responsibility to commit it?
Because the case law has, and Rule 274 specifically says, our contention is producing cause should not have been in the charge. And in order to preserve error, all we need do is assert that objection. And that's exactly what the court said, in fact, in Ledesma, and the court said in Crump, and the court said in James Baker, Continental Casualty versus James Baker, which is exactly on point.
Crump didn't really pay that. Crump, they offered, they submitted a correct charge in the way that they wanted.
Sorry, the James Baker case specifically says that all that's required is that we assert the objection. And the facts in Baker are identical to what we have here. Whereas they said producing cause wasn't part of, shouldn't be in the charge. And in that case, they objected to producing cause and they did not submit an alternate definition or instruction on producing cause. And the court said they didn't have to because all that was required is to assert that objection. Now, the other argument that they make, that counsel makes, is that we should have argued the Crump definition based on the appeals panel decision. I mean, based on the appellate decision for Crump. That doesn't apply because the appeals the appellate decision in Crump prior to the Supreme Court said they used the old definition of producing cause, not the new definition. And the Baker court, again, exactly on point. Same kind of question, producing cause, same objection, said Crump applies retroactively, and the failure to have a correct definition of producing cause was reversible error as a matter of law. We have the same scenario in this case.
Mr. Silveri,
yes.
Your time is up. Are there more questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Silveri. Mr. Lamb.
Did I save any time for rebuttal?
You have your 5 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Livingston, Justice Gardner, Justice Gabriel, I'm Robert Lamb. I represent Cindy Simpkins, who was the defendant in the trial court, the appellee in this proceeding. I'm going to divide my argument into two parts today. I'm going to address, first of all, the point of error number one, and then I'm going to spend the rest of my argument addressing point of errors two through five. With respect to point of error six, I'm going to rely on my brief and this court's opinion in the Lavender case. I believe those are dispositive on that issue. With respect to the facts in this case, I would disagree with Mr. Silveri. The facts are not stipulated. They're not solidified. There was controversy. There was a big dispute at trial in this matter. With respect to Mr. Simpkins' injury and death. And I stress injury and death because the appellant in this case wants you to focus on what caused Mr. Simpkins to fall. That is not what the focus should be. The focus is what is the cause of the injury and the death. In this case, the testimony. And Chief Justice Livingston, you asked this question of Mr. Silveri about there not being expert testimony as to the true cause of the head injury. I would disagree. There is expert testimony. There is expert testimony from Dr. Nieto. There is expert testimony from Dr. Krause, the medical examiner here in Tarrant County, that Mr. Simpkins' death was caused by a fractured skull that was caused by striking his head on the floor at Coca-Cola. The evidence is clear from many witnesses that Mr. Simpkins was working at the time that he fell. And while Mr. Silveri wants to focus, the appellant wants to focus on, well, what caused his fall, that is not the key. And there are a number of cases going back to the Garcia case, the Page case, the Wickersham case, which is a case out of this court, the Barrett case, that all address the fact that there can be reasons for somebody to fall, whether it be fainting, which was in the Bush case out of the Dallas Court of Appeals, or just some explained call. I believe some explained cause. I believe some of the cases talk about just somebody passing out for unexplained reasons. The fact is, we don't know what caused Mr. Simpkins to fall. From the video, to me, it looks like he turned, lost his balance, and fell. What we do know, and the evidence is undisputed, is that Mr. Simpkins died from fracturing his skull, from hitting it on the floor of his employer. That is a compensable injury under the law. Well, that's true, but the courts are charged with liberally construing the Workers' Compensation Act to provide coverage for employees. Employees in Texas give up their right to sue the employer, and in exchange, they have workers' compensation insurance, which is to be liberally construed in their favor to provide coverage. And if you look at the case law that talks about, and I want to talk about the Bratcher case, I think Mr. Silvera called it Bractor, but it's Bratcher. That case and the Jones case are completely distinguishable because, well, Mr. Silvera says that the Bratcher case, that the injured worker in that case fell and hit his head on a tub. In actuality, the undisputed medical evidence in the Bratcher case was that Mr. Bratcher was sitting on the toilet having a bowel movement, and he strained, and he had an aneurysm in his brain. That was what caused his death. The evidence was undisputed. And I do want to point out, because Mr. Silvera mentioned Dr. Nieto's report, which he referenced as Plaintiff's Exhibit 1, where Dr. Nieto said that Mr. Simpkins subsequently died from complications of his acute stroke. Well, if you look at the testimony, which I set out in my brief, Dr. Nieto clearly states that he is not there to offer an opinion that Mr. Simpkins died of a stroke or any other cause. He agrees with Dr. Krause. He died from falling and hitting his head. And if you look at the cases, if you're to look at, well, if somebody falls, is there a connection to the employment? If you start getting into this positional risk test and you look at the Bratcher case and you say, well, is this a compensable injury or not? You get into those line of cases where you have injured workers that are going in and out of course and scope of employment. And there are a number of decisions. I would ask for leave of court to submit a letter brief with some additional decisions that I found yesterday dealing with the Bratcher case. And there are two of them in particular that address the whole issue of Bratcher and the fact that we're not going to sit there and focus about, okay, you know, are they walking at the time that they're walking? Are they still in the course of their employment when they fall? Are they...
Anybody really debating that he was in the course of his employment? He was in the course of his employment when he fell. And
that's correct.
If you've answered my question, I missed the answer. My question is, but for what in his employment did this happen? What is the nexus between his employment other than
The nexus is that his injury was caused as a result of his employment and an instrumentality of the employer, which is the hard surface floor. And there are a number of cases.
You are making them liable strictly just because he was there when he fell.
And his injury was caused by an instrumentality of the employer. And there are a number of cases that discuss the fact that whether it be a fall from a ladder to the ground, a fall while walking and hitting your head on the ground, that is an instrumentality of the employer, and that is a compensable injury. I would like to go ahead and address the jury questions.
Yes, I want to tell you, you may submit a post-submission letter brief.
Okay.
And you'll need to do so within 10 days of argument, and then the appellee will have 10 days after that to file any response.
All right, I appreciate that, Chief Justice Livingston. With respect to the jury charge in this case, I'm going to focus on producing cause. The other complaints, I think, are addressed in my brief with respect to the definitions and instructions. I think the court gave the correct definitions and instructions. As far as the producing cause argument, I want to go back to something that Justice Gabriel said, and that was about whether you have to object to the producing cause instruction and submit, tender the court in writing a substantially correct instruction. And I want to first ask you to focus on the charge conference, which you can find in the June 8th transcript, and I believe it's pages 107, I think, to 104, or excuse me, 114. I'll get that here for a minute, in a minute. But actually, it's the June 8th transcript, 104 to 107. The only objection to producing cause that was submitted by Mr. Silvera's only objection at trial was that producing cause is not at issue in this case. And if you look at the Crump case, and I think you're correct, Justice Gabriel, the Crump case specifically points out the fact that preserving error in that case occurred when Transcontinental not only objected to the definition of producing cause as not being correct, but they did tender a substantially correct definition to the court. If you look at the Bush case that Mr. Silvera pointed out to you, I would respectfully disagree with that decision for two reasons. First of all, I think Bush is just flat wrong on saying that you don't have to tender an instruction in substantially correct form.
But and if he didn't want anything submitted about producing cause,
right,
when an objection is sufficient, how could he tender a substantially correct definition if someone doesn't want it?
Well, but he's here today to argue that it should have been in there in the form that was now adopted by the Transcontinental versus Crump Supreme Court decision. So I would agree with you. At trial, if he had wanted it submitted, he could have, although he says he can't, he could have said, you know what, I'm going to pick a pony, I'm going to ride it to the end, I'm going to take the definition that Transcontinental submitted to the Houston Court of Appeals, and I'm going to tell the court, I object to the definition that Mr. Lamb submitted of producing cause, and I'm going to go ahead and go with what Transcontinental did, even though the Houston Court of Appeals might have disagreed. He could have done that, but his position was not that producing cause was needed. His position was producing cause is not applicable in this case, which I think goes against a wealth of Texas law. In fact, if you look at the Crump case, the Supreme Court specifically recognizes that producing cause has been the standard in workers' comp cases since, I believe, 1943. So producing cause was correct. He did not preserve error by objecting to it on the basis of it being the wrong definition, an incorrect statement of law. He just didn't want it included at all. He didn't think it was applicable. Right. I do, and I'm just about to get to my second reason for disagreeing it. First is, I don't believe that they're right in saying that you don't have to submit an instruction in writing. Secondly, if you look at the Baker case, you'll see that in Baker, the objection that was made in Baker was that the definition of producing cause was not needed because it was already included in the charge submission that Continental Casualty had submitted to the court. And the objection that the Baker, insurance company, the Baker court made was that we don't need it because it's already in what we've submitted. And if you submit it again, it's confusing, it's duplicative. It's not needed because we've already got it. We've already submitted it. And that's in the decision where the court sets out the objections that were made. And the attorney for Continental clearly states that It's redundant, it's prejudicial, it's inclusive within the definition of injury and inclusive within the other definitions in the charge that Continental submitted. That was their, so I think Baker is completely distinguishable in this case. They made an objection that told the court why it wasn't necessary, and that was because it was already in the charge submitted. So I would distinguish Baker on that ground also. With respect to the charge, I do want to address very briefly the phrasing of the charge in the negative. I think that it was completely proper for the court to phrase the charge in the way they did to place the burden of proof properly. Ace Fire lost this matter at the administrative level. They lost this matter at the contested case hearing and the appeals panel. They bore the burden of proof. So for them to come in and say we had a double negative and had a burden, undue burden imposed on us, I think that's wrong. The charge was phrased to correctly tell the jury, look, they have to prove, it's already been found that Rod Simpkins had a compensable injury. The insurance company in this case has to prove that he did not. And so the charge was properly phrased to place that burden of proof on Ace. What they want is, they don't want that burden of proof. They don't want the jury knowing that they have the burden of proof. They wanted it phrased. And if you look at the charge that they submitted, they had three different questions on compensable injury that they wanted submitted to the jury. They had a 1A, a 1B, and a 1C. And so for the court in this case to look at that and say, you know what? That's not the way it should be phrased. I'm going to phrase it in the negative the way Mr. Lamb has submitted it, I think is correct. There's a wealth of case law, including the ESIS decision out of this court, that talk about it being proper to place the burden of proof and to phrase it in the insurance company must prove that the injured worker did not sustain a compensable injury. So I believe that particular portion of the charge was correct. Unless there are any other questions.
I have one.
Yes.
Do some of those cases show also the definitions that were used following question number one, which specify or clarify to me why you should answer yes or why you should answer no. Some of those cases have those kind of definitions following.
There are some of those definitions, but for the most part, the definitions I think that you will find are the ones that track the language from the labor code, which are the ones that the court adopted. And those are the ones that define what a compensable injury is or what an injury is and things of that nature. Unfortunately, not having the benefit of the Crump case at the time that we tried this case and only having the Court of Appeals case, yes, I would say that the Supreme Court changed the law. Yes. The appellee would pray for affirmance in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lamb. Mr. Silvera.
Yes.
In connection with some of the additional issues, and I'll address briefly, with regard to the jury instruction, well, let me back up. Let me talk about the first issues of point of error number 1, 2, 3, and 4 on the jury charge. The cases concerning the course and scope issue are all cases that predate the definition of compensable injury in 1991, first of all. Second of all, which now requires that the injury arise out of the employment in addition to being course and scope. Appellee in their briefing never addresses the issue of arose out of employment. All they talk about is course and scope of employment. And as Justice Gabriel indicated, there's really not a dispute concerning the fact that Mr. Simpkins is at work and doing his job. That's not the issue. The issue is, did his fall arise out of his employment? Therefore, I think all those cases are distinguishable. In addition, those cases, there's different facts in each of those cases. For instance, the Garcia case, the gentleman actually fell and hit his head on a piece of jagged metal that was sticking out from a wall. In the Wickersham case, Page, that was actually reversed and went back to trial, so we don't know exactly what happened in that particular case. But the bottom line is, some of those cases deal with what they call idiopathic falls, where the cause is unknown. Here, there was testimony as to the cause of his fall. With regard to the issue on producing cause, our contention was it should not have been submitted. And now that we have Crump, we know that the definition that was submitted constitutes reversible error. So we preserved our error, and as Mr. Lamb acknowledges, that the producing cause definition that was submitted to the jury in this case was legally incorrect. Therefore, the courts have held that constitutes harmful and reversible error. So our point of error number one should be sustained.
But if a producing cause definition should have been submitted, didn't that create a burden on you to submit a substantially correct definition or instruction?
Based on the case law and the rules, I do not believe so, Your Honor. They clearly state we have to submit an objection, because we weren't requesting, and our contention was producing cause is not an issue before the court, or before the jury. It wasn't an issue before the Workers' Comp Commission, and it wasn't an issue before the court. Therefore, we only had to object to it as stated, outlined clearly in the Baker case. What we're saying is, we now know based on Crump that the definition that was submitted, to which we objected, was legally incorrect, and therefore warrants reversal. With regard to the issues on the jury charge, and I have had a handout for you, question number one on record 90, page 91. The jury charge basically instructs the jury the effects of their answer. It tells the jury how to answer their question. The question is, do you find by a preponderance of evidence that Roderick Simpkins did not suffer compensable injury on September 9, 2005, there was a producing cause of his death? Answer one. Answer yes if you find that he did not suffer compensable injury. Answer no if you find that he did. This goes back to our all issues concerning submitting these charges in the negative. Granted, there's not one particular case. There's some cases that have submitted in the burden of proof has been assigned based on the answer. In other words, do you find for preponderance of evidence he had an injury or not? A no answer must be based on a preponderance of the evidence. And I've litigated a lot of cases in which that's how it's submitted, because it's easy and simple for the jury.
Is it submitted in this form or in a negative form in the current case?
Yes, it was. But so one, we've got the negative issue, but more importantly, we have the court instructing the jury on the effect of their answers and telling them how to answer the question.
And how is that, since it gave both alternatives of yes or no, which are clearly defined?
I understand. And the truth is, with regard to that issue, it probably doesn't rise to the level of reversible error, but it's a point of error that was raised and is argued to the court. However, the issues number one, point of error number one, and 2, 3, and 4 on the producing cause, I believe, warrants reversal. Finally, the Baker case, the Baker case talked about the issue of producing cause. And in that particular case, they indicated that their argument was, and this is on page 5 of the decision, that the standard would be result from a compensable injury. So, again, we get back to the Baker case. I believe the Baker case is exactly on point in this particular case. We would request that the jury's verdict be reversed. I believe, based on point of error number one, a decision should be rendered that Mr. Simpkins did not sustain a compensable injury in the course of scope of employment resulting in his death. And alternatively, at a minimum, based on the jury charge and the definition of producing cause, the jury's verdict must be reversed and the case remanded. Thank you.
All right, gentlemen, thank you. Your case is submitted. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. You are now excused. We will recess until our 10:30 case in the interest of AW. Thank you.
All rise.